Welcome to the 2009 Burkhardt Lecture, sponsored by the Edgar S. and Ruth W. Burkhardt Fund for History. We thank the Burkhardts for their generous support of this lecture series over the many years that they've done this. I'm Conrad Hamilton from the History Department and Chair of American Studies, and I am especially happy and honored to introduce this year's lecturer, Douglas Wilson. Doug Wilson is, quite simply, a world-renowned Lincoln scholar, and for me, this creates some difficulties. I've been told to keep this introduction short and not to list too many of his accomplishments, lest we run out of time to hear Professor Wilson's remarks. So I'll do my best. Doug Wilson came to Knox College in 1961 as an instructor in English. 3.5 decades later, after a career marked by extraordinary teaching, scholarship, and service to the college, he retired as George A. Lawrence Distinguished Service Professor. It was at this point that his real work began. Since 1997, he has been the co-director with Rod Davis of the nationally acclaimed Lincoln Studies Center at Knox. In the last 12 years, Doug has published or co-published 6 books, as well as numerous articles on Lincoln in the Atlantic Monthly, the American Heritage Magazine, and Time, as well as other magazines and scholarly journals. Doug Wilson has won the prestigious Lincoln Prize, not once, but twice. First in 1999 for his book Honor's Voice, The Transformation of Abraham Lincoln, and then again recently in 2007 for Lincoln's Sword, The Presidency and the Power of Words. Both published by Knopf Publishing. His most recent book is entitled The Lincoln-Douglas Debates, the Lincoln Studies Center Edition, co-edited with Rod Davis, available through the University of Illinois Press. Doug Wilson continues to serve on a number of advisory commissions and boards for various organizations and agencies, including the Library of Congress and the National Trust for Historic Preservation. His talk today is entitled Lincoln and Language. Would you please help me bring to the podium distinguished professor Douglas Wilson.
Very much. It's a very gratifying introduction. It's a great honor for me to be invited by my colleagues in the History Department to deliver the Burkhardt Lecture. I've had the good fortune to be acquainted with the members of the Burkhardt family who founded this lectureship, and I know them to be model supporters of Knox College in all its aspects, but I wish to pay tribute to special homage to them today for establishing this lectureship for the purpose of recognizing and encouraging scholarship as an important activity of the college. I don't have to tell most of you here that being a faculty member at a small liberal arts college is a demanding business. The success of the college depends on your being conscientious, not only in the classroom, but in the countless other tasks that must be performed outside the classroom. And the more conscientious you are, the more you're asked to do. It's no wonder that in such conditions, scholarship can so easily be deferred or neglected. But as everyone knows, scholarly activity is finally one of the important ways by which the vitality and distinction of our institutions are judged. So we honor the Burkhardts for helping to shine a light on the scholarly interests of the Knox community. When Abraham Lincoln became president, he was already a writer of great ability. But as far as the American public was concerned, this was a distinctly hidden asset. While he had earned high marks as a speaker on the stump, as well as on more formal occasions, Lincoln had no reputation as a writer with the public at large or even with his closest friends. At the time of his election, an editorial voiced the reservations of many in his own party when it asked, "Who will write this ignorant man's state papers?" But as we know, His presidential papers subsequently came to be understood as literary productions, such that he would eventually acquire standing as a writer, and in the fullness of time, a great writer. I've argued that insofar as we judge the stature of American writers by such things as the familiarity of the public with their words, or by the importance of their writings as expressions of the national purpose, Abraham Lincoln is simply unsurpassed and is probably in a class by himself. What the American public had no way of knowing in 1861 was the singular fact that Abraham Lincoln, although almost totally bereft of formal schooling, had been a keen student of language from childhood. The testimony of his family and his neighbors in Indiana, where he grew up, leaves no doubt that as a boy, he was more than merely interested in words and meanings. He was obsessed by them. The evidence bearing on this, his intellectual development in his formative years, particularly the testimony of his stepmother, suggests that what was even more important than his legendary fireside reading was his early dedication to writing. Once we're attuned to it, the lore about Lincoln and turns out to be replete with stories and examples of his longstanding preoccupation with words, his sensitivity to the diversity of their meanings, his delight in wordplay. The very first page of Michael Burlingame's new biography reports an indicative remark Lincoln made when asked about his family lineage. He said that he understood that the first American Lincolns had, quote, settled in a small Massachusetts place called Hingham, or it might have been Hangham. To read through Lincoln's writings is to uncover a persistent fascination with verbal equivocation, both as an observer and as a practitioner. He was, after all, a lawyer, and legal arguments often come down to the meanings of words or the manipulation and evasion thereof. One of the stories of his early days at the bar is ostensibly about the case of some 30 young men Lincoln was asked to defend in Frontier Menard County who'd been arrested for playing cards. In my reading of it, the story is more about the clueless prosecutor who knew nothing about card games, but since there were allegedly two different games involved, he thought he could show these rude miscreants how the prosecutorial game should be played. To assure that they felt the full force of the enormity of their crime, he brought one indictment against them for playing a game identified as 7-Up, and a second indictment for playing another designated as Old Sledge. Two games, two indictments. But for all he knew about the law, there was something he didn't know that everyone else in the courtroom did, that these were two different names for the same game. So when the first charge was brought, the sympathetic witnesses solemnly testified that the defendants accused of playing 7-Up were playing Old Sledge, with the result that all were acquitted. For the officious prosecutor, this must have been bad enough. But imagine his chagrin and the crowd's delight when the second charge was brought and all the witnesses testified that those accused of playing Old Sledge were playing 7-Up. This is admittedly equivocation at a primitive level, but Lincoln's experience with it covered a wide range. It's arguably one of the reasons he favored Macbeth over all other Shakespearean plays. For as Gary Wills has shown in his book, Witches and Jesuits, equivocation is a deeply embedded theme in that play. The issue of equivocation, in fact, entered Lincoln's most anguished meditations, such as those that underlay his long struggle as president to fathom the direction and purpose of divine providence in the course of a horrendous civil war. With these matters very much on his mind in the autumn of 1864, he told a visitor that when he called, he, the president, had been, quote, deep in Pope. And he quoted from memory the famous passage from Alexander Pope's Essay on Man that concludes with these lines. In spite of pride, in erring reason's spite, one truth is clear, whatever is right. When his visitor remarked on the beauty of this passage, Lincoln reportedly said, "Yes, that's a convenient line, too, that last one." You see, a man may turn it and say, "Well, if whatever is right, why then whatever isn't must be wrong." One of the very few public speeches that Lincoln gave as president, and one that deserves to be better known, was delivered at the Baltimore Sanitary Fair in April of 1864. And it contains a notable example of Lincoln using the issue of verbal equivocation for a serious political purpose. Here, the subject is something he cared deeply about and that was somehow at the center of the national crisis, the concept of liberty. "The world," he says, "has never had a good definition of the word liberty, and the American people just now are much in want of one. We all declare for liberty, but in using the same word, we do not all mean the same thing. With some, the word liberty may mean for each man to do as he pleases with himself and the product of his labor, while with others, the same word may mean for some men to do as they please with other men and the product of other men's labors. Here are two not only different, but incompatible meanings, called by the same name, liberty. And it follows that each of the things is, by the respective parties, called by two different and incompatible names, liberty and tyranny." As a boy, Lincoln had read every book he could lay his hands on, which resulted in a motley collection of literary models. But one book that had an undoubted and enduring impact was Aesop's Fables, as is evident in the passage that follows the one I just read. "The shepherd drives the wolf from the sheep's throat, for which the sheep thanks the shepherd as a liberator, while the wolf denounces him for the same act as a destroyer of liberty, especially as the sheep was a black one. Plainly, the sheep and the wolf are not agreed on a definition of liberty, and precisely the same difference prevails today among us human creatures, even in the North, and all professing to love liberty. Here we behold the process by which thousands are daily passing from under the yoke of bondage, hailed by some as the advance of liberty and bewailed by others as the destruction of liberty." There are a number of reasons why Lincoln had chosen to speak in Baltimore, but the most important was surely to call attention to the dramatic turnaround that Baltimore and the state of Maryland represented. At the outset of the Civil War, there had been powerful forces at work in Maryland, especially in Baltimore, first to oppose Lincoln's inauguration, and later, after the firing on Fort Sumter, to impede his efforts to defend the Capitol, to say nothing of the attempts by the same forces to bring about Maryland's secession from the Union. But now, 3 years later, the state of Maryland was preparing to do something quite astonishing and monumental. It was about to abolish slavery. This is what Lincoln refers to in the sentence that follows his Aesopian fable on liberty. "Recently," he says, "as it seems, the people of Maryland have been doing something to define liberty. And thanks to them, that in what they've done, the Wolf's Dictionary has been repudiated." There's a world of meaning packed into Lincoln's provocative metaphor, the Wolf's Dictionary, but it will suffice for our purposes here simply to point out Lincoln's way of exploiting the opportunity presented by Maryland's forthcoming Emancipation Act was to focus on the importance of words. What he said in Baltimore in 1864 is reminiscent of something he had said in one of the many manuscript fragments that survived from the 1850s. Here he used a familiar line from the biblical book of Proverbs: "A word fitly spoken is like apples of gold in pictures of silver." He used this line to produce what is arguably his most effective illustration of his belief in the primacy of the Declaration of Independence in American polity. Important as the Constitution and the Union are to Americans, he argued, they are not the primary cause of our great prosperity. There is something back of these, entwining itself more closely about the human heart. That something is the principle of liberty to all. The Declaration's assertion of that principle at that time was the word fitly spoken, which has proved an apple of gold to us. The Union and the Constitution are the picture of silver, subsequently framed around it. The picture was made not to conceal or destroy the apple, but to adorn and preserve it. The picture was made for the apple, not the apple for the picture. Another of Lincoln's speeches that deserves to be better known is his address to the Wisconsin Agricultural Fair, delivered in Milwaukee in September 1859. Robin and I have a special interest in the Wisconsin State Fair, which is still given, of course. While not a political speech, it has, as John Channing Brigg has noted, a definite political edge. And this is evident in the way Lincoln opens the address. Having been preoccupied for all of 5 years creating a new political party, a fusion party, as it was called, composed of former political adversaries, it's no accident that Lincoln began his address by emphasizing the good that agricultural fairs do by bringing people together. This is the burden of the first sentence. But in the second sentence, he brings this notion alive by a specific appeal to specific words. From the first appearance of man upon the earth, down to very recent times, the words stranger and enemy were quite and almost synonymous. Long after civilized nations had defined robbery and murder as high crimes and had affixed severe punishments to them, when practiced among and upon their own people, it was deemed no offense, but even meritorious, to rob and murder and enslave strangers, whether as nations or as individuals. Even yet, this has not totally disappeared. Starting out with what looks like a commonplace, fairs bring people together, Lincoln's appeal to the word stranger and enemy galvanizes our attention, and by the third sentence, we're swept into the story of civilization, literally the civilizing of society, a process that, by Lincoln's telling, was still incomplete. Along the way, the issue of enslavement has been quietly inserted into the discussion as one of man's inhumanities to man that has, quote, not totally disappeared. This is part of the political edge we spoke of earlier, but it is most pronounced in connection with the discussion of labor, where Lincoln tackles a particular rationalization of slavery, then being touted as the mudsill theory. The mudsill theory, first expounded by a U.S. senator from South Carolina, James Henry Hammond, in 1858, held that, quote, in all social systems, there must be a class to do the menial duties, to perform the drudgery of life. And without such a class, you would not have that other class that leads progress, civilization, and refinement. The South, Hammond proclaimed from the floor of the Senate, has fortunately, quote, found a race adapted to that purpose and called them slaves. The North, he said, also has a mudsill class, and while it deigned not to use the word, quote, the whole hireling class of manual laborers are essentially slaves. A dispute about free labor and the meaning of the word slave was tailor-made for a person of Lincoln's political and linguistic interests. The chief obstacle a modern reader has with this passage is the unfamiliarity of the key word mudsill, on which everything turns. As almost everyone in Lincoln's audience in 1859 would have known, this word refers to the lowest structural part of a building, whether a board or a stone or a block. The bottommost member was called a mudsill, and it was the kind of word that Lincoln relished because its metaphorical potential, with its invidious connotations for human beings, played right into his hands. According to that theory, Lincoln says, the education of laborers is not only useless, but pernicious and dangerous. In fact, it is in some sort deemed a misfortune that laborers should have heads at all. Those same heads are regarded as explosive materials, only to be kept safely in damp places as far as possible from the sort of fire that ignites them. A Yankee who could invent a strong-handed man without a head would receive the everlasting gratitude of the mud sill advocates. Here Lincoln zeroes in on something that is completely ignored or overlooked by the mud sill theorists, namely the intellectual potential of this hireling class of manual laborers. This, of course, the main point of the passage, and its effectiveness as an argument is much enhanced by his audience's instinctive identification with the mud sill laborers and Lincoln's depiction of them as having heads as well as hands. But we should also note the way Lincoln's argument is quickened by the striking phrase he uses to characterize the minds of the mud sill laborers: explosive materials. For Lincoln's audience, and especially as applied to the mud sills he was talking about, this was more than a little audacious, and as such it represents a characteristic Lincolnian touch, his constant affinity for unexpected and quietly electrifying language. Students of Lincoln are indebted to Lincoln's stepmother, Sarah Bush Lincoln, who revealed the salient fact that even as a boy, Lincoln had a passion for clarity of expression. Sometimes, she said, he seemed pestered to give expression to his ideas and got mad almost at one who couldn't explain plainly what he wanted to convey. Observe, if you will, that this statement is in two parts. She tells us first that the boy was pestered to find the right words for his own ideas, but also that he was impatient with other people who had the same problem. Directly confirming this recollection is something that Lincoln in 1860 told a future president of Knox College, Reverend John P. Gulliver, who had complimented him on the clarity of his statements. Lincoln replied by telling Gulliver that, among my earliest recollections, I remember how, when a mere child, I used to get irritated when anybody talked to me in a way I could not understand. For his part, Lincoln said he was never satisfied, quote, until I had put it in language plain enough, as I thought, for any boy I knew to comprehend. Just as his stepmother had suggested, what Lincoln told Gulliver connected his obsession with clarity to his writing, which he says he actively employed as an aid to understanding. Lincoln's continued pursuit of clarity in later life was not lost on those associated with him. His longtime friend in politics and at the bar, Judge Joseph Gillespie, said, if Mr. Lincoln studied any one thing more than another, and for effect, it was to make himself understood by all classes. He had great natural clearness and simplicity of statement, and this faculty he cultivated with marked assiduity. Judge Gillespie's characterization is helpful in representing Lincoln's clarity as seemingly a natural attribute, yet one that he did not take for granted, but worked hard at. Lincoln's law partner, William H. Herndon, described the same phenomenon in a letter to his collaborator, emphasizing the assiduity. Lincoln always struggled to see the thing or the idea exactly, and to express that idea in such language as to convey the idea precisely. He used to bore me terribly by his methods and processes and manner and so forth. He would doubly explain things to me that needed no explanation. Lincoln's ambition in this line was this. He wanted to be distinctly understood by common people. As president, this changed very little. Harriet Beecher Stowe reported in 1864 that, quote, our own politicians were somewhat shocked with his state papers, and that attempts had been made to get Lincoln to let other, more experienced hands do this kind of writing for him. Stowe represented Lincoln as saying, no, I shall write them myself. The people will understand them. Understanding was still the great test. It's useful, I believe, to see Lincoln's writing not only as a medium for expressing his political arguments and ideas, but as being directly related to the extraordinary cultural and literary ferment of the 1850s. Consider, for instance, this brief list of some of the works of that decade that would eventually be recognized as American classics of the first order. 1850, Nathaniel Hawthorne's The Scarlet Letter. 1851, Herman Melville, Moby Dick. 1854, Henry David Thoreau's Walden. 1855, Walt Whitman's Leaves of Grass. 1858, Emily Dickinson's first hand-sewn fascicle of manuscript poems. Another work that seems destined to be accorded that comparable stature, in my view, is Frederick Douglass's My Bondage and My Freedom, which was published in 1855. If we consider that this sudden eruption of landmark literary works marks a revolution in the nature and quality of American writing, it's hardly an accident that Abraham Lincoln, in enunciating a political and personal reawakening over the extension of slavery, suddenly found a powerful new voice in 1854 in what is known as his Peoria speech, arguably the greatest of his pre-presidential speeches. In this perspective, Lincoln's emergence in the 1850s, which is usually regarded in a purely political aspect, can be seen as part of the flowering of art and expression that F.O. Matheson famously called an American Renaissance. Seeing Lincoln's writing in this perspective helps to account for the distinctive character of his prose. When it began to attract attention during his presidency, the word that even sympathetic journalists commonly used to characterize it was peculiar, a word that was in fact used by Herndon himself. What they were referring to is essentially this. Largely to achieve clarity of expression and be widely understood, Lincoln had for 20 years been deliberately and quite self-consciously perfecting a discourse of plain language. The result was far more evident in his own day than it is in ours, for he lived in an era in which elevated and self-consciously literary diction was an expected part of public speech and writing. An imposing vocabulary was the acknowledged mark of learning and refinement, when those were almost synonymous terms with respectable discourse, written or spoken. But Lincoln's well-attested passion for clarity and for making his ideas and arguments understood by ordinary citizens implied, if not dictated, a plainness in diction. By his own rule, to use words and expression that your audience was not familiar with made little sense. True, it was always possible to charm and beguile an audience by talking over their heads. Ralph Waldo Emerson was notorious for making his living this way. But if you wanted to change the minds of farmers and storekeepers and ordinary folks and persuade them to accept new ideas and positions, Lincoln's theory was that you must speak their language. His law partner Herndon, who was also a frequent public speaker, reported that Lincoln often counseled him not to shoot too high, shoot low down, and the common people will understand you. The educated ones will understand you anyhow. The first Lincoln speech of which we have a complete text, his Lyceum Address of January 1838, is written in language that was fairly conventional for the oratory of that day, but much of it sounds decidedly un-Lincolnian. Take, for example, what is one of the best-known sentences Abraham Lincoln ever wrote, the opening of the Gettysburg Address. 47 years ago, our fathers brought forth on this continent a new nation conceived in liberty and dedicated to the proposition that all men are created equal. That's Lincolnian. Compare this with a statement in the Lyceum Address that expresses very nearly the same idea. Speaking of the founding fathers, he says, "Theirs was the task, and nobly they performed it, to possess themselves, and through themselves us, of this goodly land, and to uprear upon its hills and its valleys a political edifice of liberty and equal rights." This sounds closer to Senator Claghorn than Abraham Lincoln. But what I'd like to call attention here to is that not long after he delivered this speech, the manner and diction of Lincoln's written speeches began to change. This was, for example, the last edifice he would ever uprear for these two words, along with a great many others from the Lyceum speech, thereafter simply disappear from his written vocabulary. A wonderfully useful feature of the online version of the collected works Lincoln's collected works is called The Word Index. And it's greatly enhanced the study of Lincoln's vocabulary by making it possible to identify and track every word Lincoln employed in his writing. Using his 1838 Lyceum address as a baseline, we can readily see that certain words, such as salubrity, unprofaned, bane, prattle, like uprear, effectively were banished from his written vocabulary and never used again. Certain familiar expressions share the same fate. Lisping babes, towering genius, monuments of fame. Which reminds us that long before Strunk and White, discerning writers recognized that overused expressions should be avoided. Lincoln's vocabulary, especially when he was young, was built up from his reading, and it's sometimes possible to be reasonably certain where he got his expressions. In his 1832 announcement of his candidacy for the legislature, for example, his use of the compound word heart appalling to describe the cost of building railroads almost certainly comes from the preface of a book he listed as part of his early reading, James Riley's Narrative. Not only did he not repeat the unusual word heart appalling, he thereafter never even used the more common expression, appalling. These verbal disappearances serve as an indication that diction, the choice and use of words and phrases, involves the avoidance of words and phrases as well as the acquisition and employment of new ones. In gradually working towards a discourse of plain language, Lincoln was simplifying his working vocabulary by actively shedding some of the words that attracted him early in his career. Take the word uprear, which appears in the 1838 Lyceum address and nowhere else. While not a word that he would have picked up in conversation around New Salem, it's not hard to fathom where he got it, as it was a word often used by the English poets he was reading and reciting so assiduously at this time of his life. One of these poems, for example, was Lord Byron's Childe Harold's Pilgrimage, in which Byron more than once uses uprear in precisely the same context. Lincoln would have come across this word in the works of his favorite author, William Shakespeare, for example, in Sonnet 49, or in the prologue to Henry V, the famous Muse of Fire speech, which Lincoln probably knew by heart. Here is the passage. Suppose within the girdle of these walls are now confined two mighty monarchies, whose high upreared and abutting fronts the perilous narrow ocean parts asunder. I quote this mainly to show the Shakespearean vocabulary to which the word uprear belongs. And much as Lincoln loved it in traditional English poetry, how inappropriate it would be to the plain discourse he was developing with which to reach and persuade his Illinois audience. This is at least part of the answer to the question that is so often asked. If Lincoln was such a keen student of Shakespeare all his life, where can we see the evidence of that in his writing? The answer suggested here is not in his diction and vocabulary. While he knew and relished Shakespearean language, the discipline of plain discourse ruled it out. He did not, of course, reform his diction overnight, but the next speech after the Lyceum address, of which we have a complete text, his sub-treasury speech, nearly 2 years later, is notable for the comparative absence of the 25-cent words that decorate the Lyceum address. Part of the difference may reflect the pressure he was under, having disappointed his Whig friends with a lackluster performance in an earlier appearance. In bearing down to redeem himself, he focused intently on marshaling arguments in forceful, direct language such as this. By the sub-treasury, the revenue is to be collected and kept in iron boxes until the government wants it for disbursement, thus robbing the people of the use of it while the government itself does not need it, and while the money is performing no nobler office than that of rusting in iron boxes. The natural effect of this change of policy, everyone will see, is to reduce the quantity of money in circulation. One can hear at least a hint of the mature Lincoln prose in that. By the time he came to the presidency, his prose was mature, but this was either not apparent or made little difference to those who didn't know much about him, particularly the large number who were suspicious of his presidential qualifications. For someone like the ex-slave Frederick Douglass, another autodidact with a remarkable gift for expression, and one who was sharply critical of the government's policies, the president's plain style reflected his shortcomings. When in August of 1862, Lincoln met with black leaders to urge a scheme of colonization, Douglass was furious, especially since the president had appeared to put the blame for the Civil War on blacks. In denouncing the meeting and the president in his magazine, Douglass struck out at Lincoln's language. We might also criticize the style adopted, so exceedingly plain and coarse-threaded as to make the impression that Mr. Lincoln had such a low estimate of the intelligence of his audience as to think any but the simplest phrases and constructions would be to approve their would be above their power of comprehension. As Mr. Lincoln, however, in all his writings, has manifested a deciding awkwardness in the management of the English language, we do not think there is any intention in this respect, but only the incapacity to do better. But Douglass wrote this in anger, and before he had any personal acquaintance with Lincoln. After the issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation, followed by two memorable encounters in the president's office, and a warm reception at the White House following the second inaugural, Douglass became an admirer, not just of Lincoln himself, but of his use of language. In my interviews with him, he would later write, I found him, as I have already described him, a plain man. There was neither paint nor varnish about him. His manners were simple, unaffected, unstudied. His language, like himself, was plain, strong, and sinewy, just as it appears in his written productions. He spoke as he wrote, without ornament. Earnest always, but never extravagant. I never met a man who could state more clearly and forcibly just what he wished to make apparent. The plainness of Lincoln's mature prose style consisted of a great deal more than plain diction. A technique that surely owes something to his career in the courtroom, that turns up frequently in his presidential writing, is the practice of putting what are essentially declarative statements in the form of pointedly worded questions. In his message to Congress of July 4, 1861, in which he laid out the basis on which the Civil War would be fought, Lincoln used this strategy to good effect. In defending his suspension of the habeas corpus in Maryland, for example, where troops were coming to the defense of the government or being harassed and obstructed, he cut through the legal and constitutional entanglements by putting a question that was blazingly clear. To state the question more directly, are all the laws but one to go unexecuted, and the government itself go to pieces, lest that one be violated? Lincoln's reference to his question, putting his question more directly, spotlights another characteristic of Lincoln's use of language that was certainly unexpected and probably considered in governmental prose distinctly odd: directness. Like a shrewd military commander, Lincoln knew the strategic value, under the right circumstances, of going straight at his opponent. When Horace Greeley attacked him publicly in his newspaper in 1862, demanding in long, scolding harangue that he spell out his policy, Lincoln replied with something he'd already written that was breathtakingly direct: I would save the Union. In another of his public letters, he began by directly confronting his critics. There are those of you who are dissatisfied with me. To such I would say, you desire peace, and you blame me that we do not have it. But how can we attain it? There are but three conceivable ways. First, to suppress the rebellion by force of arms. This I am trying to do. Are you for it? If you are, so far we are agreed. If you are not, a second way is to give up the Union. I am against this. By seizing the initiative, he is here able to set the agenda and establish a tangible momentum. The means of accomplishing this feat are directly related to the language employed, which we should note consists almost entirely of one-syllable words. Or consider the way he begins his only known law lecture. I am not an accomplished lawyer. This is equally direct, but not confrontational. It is instead ingratiating by its unexpected candor. Manuscripts can sometimes be helpful in showing the writer actively engaged in rhetorical strategies, and I know of no better example than the manuscript for this lecture. Further on, Lincoln begins his third paragraph, "Never encourage litigation." What could be more direct and emphatic than a three-word sentence? The manuscript shows Lincoln in the act of seeking an answer, for he struck out the words, "Never encourage," and created a two-word sentence that was even more direct and more emphatic, "Discourage litigation." We've been speaking of clarity, plainness of diction, declarative interrogatories, directness, seizing rhetorical initiative, maintaining an argumentative momentum. A comprehensive example encompassing all of these is found in Lincoln's response to his devious Secretary of State, Salmon P. Chase, who in September 1863 urged the President, for shamelessly expedient reasons, to rescind certain territorial exemptions specified in the Emancipation Proclamation. Whether Lincoln thought that Chase couldn't see that what he was urging was ill-advised, or whether he suspected that getting him to take such a false step was exactly what Chase had in mind, Lincoln wrote a quietly ripping refusal that covered both possibilities. "If I take the step, must I not do so without any argument of military necessity, and so without any argument except the one that I think the measure politically expedient and morally right? Would I not thus give up all footing upon Constitution and law? Would I not thus be in the boundless field of absolutism? Could this pass unnoticed or unresisted? Could it fail to be perceived that without any further stretch I might do the same in Delaware, Maryland, Kentucky, Tennessee, Missouri, and even change any law in any state? Would not many of our own friends shrink away, appalled? Would it not lose us the elections, and with them the very cause we seek to advance?" Facility with which Lincoln finds and runs out fatal objections to Chase's plan seemingly leaves little choice between a judgment of either ineptitude or disloyalty. This may explain why this incisive letter is unsigned and possibly remained unsent. If Lincoln's foremost aim was indeed that of clarity, of being understood by a wide range of auditors, he certainly did not intend thereby to sacrifice persuasiveness. While he avoided the florid, ornamental language of conventional oratory, at the same time, he was consciously cultivating a keen sense of cadence and developing a variety of rhythmic and rhetorical effects that, even though he was using ordinary language, could result in a kind of prose poetry for which his best presidential writings are known. Here's a passage from an early speech on temperance that deals with the prosaic subject of the merchandising of liquor. "Wagons drew it from town to town. Boats bore it from clime to clime. And the winds wafted it from nation to nation. And merchants bought it and sold it by wholesale and by retail, with precisely the same feelings on the part of the seller, buyer, and bystander as are felt at the selling and buying of flour, beef, bacon, or any of the other necessaries of life." There's nothing here to rival the Gettysburg Address or the Second Inaugural, but the cadenced cataloging, which lends interest to the presentation, may be seen as something of a harbinger of the later style. The Milwaukee Address, which was written 17 years later, in 1859, contains a more developed example of the same mode. And what is so noteworthy here is that the writer most likely to be brought to mind by this passage to a modern-day reader is Walt Whitman. Less surprising, but perhaps more venturesome, is that Lincoln's subject, before an audience of farmers, is unabashedly intellectual, focusing on the way in which farming presents the mind with what he calls an exhaustless source of profitable enjoyment. "Every blade of grass is a study, and to produce two where there was but one is both a profit and a pleasure. And not grass alone, but soils, seeds and seasons, hedges, ditches, fences, draining, droughts and irrigation, plowing, hoeing and harrowing, reaping, moving and threshing, saving crops, pests of crops, diseases of crops, and what will prevent or cure them, implements, utensils and machines, their relative merits and how to improve them, hogs, horses and cattle, sheep, goats and poultry, trees, shrubs, fruits, plants and flowers, the thousands of things of which these are specimens, each a world of study within itself. Like the one in the Temperance Address, this brief passage in the Milwaukee Address is not a full-fledged mode of expression, but more of an exercise, an etude that promises greater things to come. In his eulogy to his bold ideal of a statesman, Henry Clay, Lincoln wrote that Clay's eloquence did not result from the use of rhetorical devices, but rather from impassioned tone, that's a quote, that comes from deep conviction. The same might be said of Lincoln's eloquence, yet the devices are undoubtedly there. Nearly 100 years ago, Charles Smiley, an American professor of classics at Grinnell College, traveled to Berlin, then the mecca of classical studies, to spend a winter immersed in ancient Greek texts. A true American, Professor Smiley deliberately carried with him the everyman selection of Lincoln's speeches and letters to serve, he says, as an antidote against Prussian bureaucracy and despotism. The everyman Lincoln was also expected to serve as an antidote to the object of his study, Leonard von Spengel's three-volume edition of the ancient Greek rhetoricians. As Professor Smiley put it in un-Lincolnian diction, after a, quote, careful study of the flowers of speech in the ancient world, what could be more refreshing than a look into some old-fashioned garden, into some book unbedizened with any form of meretricious embellishment? What the professor found instead, when he turned from the ancient Greeks to the untutored American statesman, was that Lincoln's best writings exhibited clear-cut examples of the very rhetorical devices identified with Gorgias, a flamboyant rhetorician whose practice had been severely censured by Aristotle as exhibiting, quote, the marks of superficial sham and insincerity. And yet Smiley discovered that the Gettysburg Address, for example, had, quote, two antitheses, five cases of anaphora, eight instances of balanced phrases and clauses, and 13 alliterations. Lincoln's famous letter to Horace Greeley was even more Gorgian. In 44 lines, we have six completely balanced sentences, eight cases of anaphora, six instances of similar clause endings, and six antitheses. Even the passage in praise of Helen attributed to Gorgias, Smiley tells us, is not so completely Gorgian in its embellishment. Professor Smiley's discovery spotlights something important about Lincoln's use of language, and ultimately his eloquence. Though submerged and generally inconspicuous, the same rhetorical devices that have been suspect since ancient times as telltale times signs of superficiality and insincerity, are nonetheless part and parcel of many of Lincoln's most inspiring works. In being, in his hands, somehow unobtrusive, they have not only not stigmatized the writer, but, in Smiley's words, had somehow proved themselves capable of sincerity. Professor Smiley's conclusion is reminiscent of that of Gillespie, Herndon, and many others on the subject, but has never been better stated. Lincoln cared more for his thought than his style, but he cared so much for his thought that he studied with care the means of making it incisive and effective. I want to close these remarks on Lincoln and language by calling attention to the way he closes the Milwaukee Address, which is with a story about the ideal sentence. This is another Aesopian fable, story of an Eastern monarch who charges his wise men to invent a sentence, quote, which should be true and appropriate in all times and situations. The wise men presented him with the words, "And this too shall pass away." Lincoln grants that this ultimate sentence is wonderfully expressive, so chastening, he says, in the hour of pride, and consoling in the depths of affliction. Yet, he says, shifting to a theme so much admired and emulated by President Obama, let us hope that it is not quite true. Let us hope, rather, that by the best cultivation of the physical world beneath and around us, and by the intellectual and moral world within us, we shall secure an individual, social, and political prosperity and happiness whose course shall be onward and upward, and which, while the earth endures, shall not pass away. Thanks very much.
Professor Wilson will answer a few questions.
If there be such. Ed?
Doug, I was kind of curious, but given the way you began with the equivocation and ambiguity and wordplay of at least the early Lincoln, if there is any connection with the use of language to that tradition, I guess I think of it as a similar kind that's had a lot of scholarship over the years, of frontier humor. Is there any parallel in the way language is used in his works and the kinds of frontier humor that were beginning to be published and known at the time?
I think the way I would answer that is this. Lincoln does say some amusing things, some very amusing things in his speeches, but generally he doesn't tell his good stories. In conversation, almost all the Lincoln stories that we know are ones that are reported from conversation. And in conversation, he was hilarious. And Horace White, who traveled with him in 1858 as a journalist and really as an advisor and friend, said that he could just absolutely reduce the room. Everybody would end up on the floor crying and begging for mercy because he made them laugh so hard. And he says that he once asked Lincoln, "Why don't you use that humor more in your against Douglas?" And Lincoln says, "I've never believed that you could persuade people that way by making them laugh." And so he doesn't. And there's another consideration that I'm sure that you are aware of, and that is that the literary frontier humor that he did like and read, most people thought was terrible, and we don't find most of that very funny now when we read it, but Lincoln did. It really struck his fancy, and that sort of set him apart really in the cabinet. The cabinet. He would read these stories to the cabinet. They all roll their eyes, look at each other. So I think that even though he knew that humor, he knew the jokes and the stories, you don't find him using that much in his serious writing.
I appreciated the full development of your remarks, Doug, and I guess maybe what I'm seeking is a kind of clarification related to some of my own thinking about Lincoln's language. And it seems to me that you're allowing, that your stress on clarity in relationship to diction doesn't exclude the possibility that clarity might still be achieved while using metaphoric language and using complex syntax, which it does seem to me that Lincoln engages in. And I even sort of think of the syntax as Shakespearean sometimes, if not the diction. But in any event, sometimes clarity is argued for simplicity of syntax and perhaps an avoidance of the ambiguity that relates to metaphoric language. But it seems that Lincoln was able to use that as well as stressing the clarity of diction.
Well, I certainly, anytime you bear down on something, you run the risk of overemphasizing it to the exclusion of other things. There's lots of other things to say. You know, the thing about the syntax of Shakespearean, I'm interested in that. I'd like to see it demonstrated. My own sense is that he would be leery of that. Although he has his own, he has his own voice, which is ultimately syntactical, at least in one important respect. And of course, reading Shakespeare all of his life has got to affect him. It's just, I'm be the first to say that it's in there somewhere, but it's not in the diction. And that's true. I mean, he was really a lover of English poetry and read it, especially when he was young. And then afterwards, he liked to recite. And since he memorized all of this poetry, some people said he could recite all of Burns. I think these are really people who are complaining. More Burns than they wanted. You know. But he could recite by the hour, and he liked to do that. That's the way he liked to spend an afternoon or an evening. He liked to be the center of attention. He'd been that all of his life. That was part of his way of being social. His wife, of course, hated it because when they would have a social, and all the men would gather around him, and then that would take the men out of circulation in the social. But I think the reason for stressing the thing about clarity is that there are always various levels at which you can take on somebody's use of language. But it seemed to me that this goes all the way back. And all the way down, as it were, and all the way in. I mean, it's primary, and all of his friends talk about it. And I think you can see it in his. I think one of the things is that he doesn't write like Hemingway. When we say ordinary vocabulary, we're not talking about trying to get it reduced to the vocabulary of conversation. We're talking about what people are used to reading in the newspaper. And what they would, what would be a working vocabulary? If he uses words that aren't part of our working vocabulary, they've simply gone out of style or they've drifted off to the edge somewhere. But I'm sure that's the test with him. He uses words that maybe seem a little highfalutin to us, but they wouldn't have been beyond the reach of the people he was trying to be outside of their vocabularies. And he doesn't use really fancy words that you have to say, what? And one of the reasons I think this is important is that the more you know about Lincoln, the more you understand this guy is deeply intellectual. He's deeply contemplative. His friends are all frustrated because they know that he's thinking all the time. They just don't know what he's thinking about. And they know that he's very deep. He's very philosophical. He's interested in the great philosophical questions. But he has to untangle. He has to get out of that mindset when he goes to talk politics or he goes to propose things. And so I see a real achievement there. It'd be one thing if you didn't have that complication of having a brooding, questioning, skeptical, intellectual mind and having a philosophical conversation going on in your head all the time, as he apparently did. Because that would tend to inhibit or complicate in some way this effort to be clear. But somehow he was managed to keep those things apart. Yeah?
Well, this might be an unfair question, but you did make a comparison at some point with Lincoln and our current president. And, you know, Obama is a... He loves Lincoln. He's a Lincolnophile in a sense. And I'm just wondering, in light of what you're saying about the language that Lincoln is using and the idea that he has all of his intellectual ferment going on, do you see any, are there any comparisons to be made to President Obama, who sometimes is seen as being too intellectual or too, you know, and having to kind of disguise that in a sense?
Yeah, well, those are all very intriguing questions, and I'm sure that as we get to know him better and we see him in action, he gets more and more, he can't get out in front of the spotlight now, that which means that we'll probably see less of the real Obama, I don't know. But certainly all the indications are pretty clear that he's a reader, he's a writer, he's a word guy, he likes Lincoln, he feels an affinity for Lincoln, and they're in the same business. I think he's careful, though, not to just get so close to the model that there'd be a cost to pay for that. Rodney and I, Rod Davis and I, Rodney's not able to be here today, we got a lot of calls about the inauguration, and even a Frankfurt, Germany newspaper, Ross helped us with this, the American editor of this newspaper said, I would like to ask you about what's Lincolnian about the inaugural address, so after it's given, could we call you up and ask you? So Rodney and I, I've got the speech in front of me. Again, right? The New York Times and print it out, you know. And, you know, and we heard it and we read it again and read it two or three times. And when they called up, we said, I mean, he's deliberately not making the kinds of allusions to Lincoln speeches as he did in Grant Park or his various other important speeches. So I think that was deliberate. I think he would said, I'm not going to get caught in this trap of people say, well, you know, he's just spouting Lincoln all the time. This is kind of a cheap trick. So I think that we'll probably see a very judicious use of Lincoln's words. I'm certainly persuaded that he's a really good writer. I think the first book is terrific. And I think the crucial speeches that he had to give in the campaign, I think he really kept his campaign together and kept it going some very important times. And of course, he got all of our attention by a speech that he apparently worked very, very hard on, the speech that he gave the Democratic Convention in 2004. And he is, I mean, he's got the Lincolnian stuff. He is really good in giving a speech. He gives a great speech, but and the more he works on it, the better it is. I think that's the way Lincoln worked too. So I don't know. We're just going to have to keep watching. I think it'll be interesting. Dave.
Doug, I wonder if you could be picking up, I think, on something that Rob was talking about. My sense is that when you're talking about that clarity, for us, it seems to me one part of that would be short sentences as well. But I don't sense that in him. And
He savors the short sentence. He saves it up, you know.
Yeah.
You
know. Mm-hmm. The hammer with it.
But that also part of that is that there would be the popular understanding could encompass more complex sentences now than probably in our sort of post-marketing,
yeah,
post-newspaper,
right,
age.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, probably. Yeah, because people did, politics was exciting in the way, I'm sure there are lots of people who are excited in the way that people were excited in the Lincoln-Douglas debate days, but it was a time when people, it was a time of a much ferment, and people were excited by politics, and so they had a stronger thirst for political prose than we have, I think, by and large. So he lived, and that brings out the best in the performers, I would think. And I think that's probably true. Certainly brought out the best in him, and I think he just got better and better. The pressure of the president, which almost killed him, if you look at those photographs, by the time he gives the second inaugural, he just looks terrible. But somehow that pressure worked to the benefit of literature, to the benefit of inspiration, he paid a cost for it, so that it wouldn't be surprising to find the opposite. That is, the more and more he got worn down by the war and the anguish and the blood and the suffering and the contention. And of course, he is the man beset. The leaders of his own party are always after him. I mean, he's getting it from all sides. But he seemed to write better under those. And he was always writing. He was always working on his writing. He always wanted to work on those words that he was going to present. So eventually got so he wouldn't make any kind of speech extemporaneously when he's president. You know, this wonderful moment at Gettysburg when the crowd, comes to serenade him. They bring the band. They're all drinking and having a good time. The town is full of people, and they say, "Give us a speech." And he says, "I can't do that." He says, "It's important because of the position I occupy that I not say something foolish." And somebody in the crowd says, "Yeah, if you can help it." And he says, "You're right." He says, "And the only way that I can really help it is to not make any speech at all." Yeah, Penny.
This is kind of a tangent, but I'm interested in this notion of speaking in the words that people will understand, and thinking of it from a teaching perspective. And I think as a teacher, there's always choices about what words to use. And I wonder if it's a different context, teaching and political persuasion, or whether there's something the same. And I don't know if you could draw it just. This is not about Lincoln. It's more about your reflection on a life of teaching also, and thinking of it in this context, and how appropriate is it to use words people don't understand in an effort to push to another. I don't know. It got me thinking about that.
Well, I think you're right. I think that there's a point. There's always that question of do we try to expand people's vocabularies by using words and showing that they need this word. This is the word that you need if you're going to talk about this.
I guess as a politician, he can't stop to explain a word that he uses. But a lot of speakers. I mean, I think of times when I was a student, in particular, I'd get miffed when people would give lectures and use this vocabulary beyond me. But maybe that was a good thing.
That the irritation.
Yeah.
Yes, I think you could say that in Lincoln's situation, he was the only kid in Gentryville who was worried about the meaning of the words that some adult passing through the community was using that he couldn't understand. Mm-hmm. They were the happy ones. He was the troubled one. So we're glad that he was troubled.
You find any evidence that Jefferson influenced him?
Well, he certainly knew Jefferson. He read him. Jefferson is a great writer. He certainly is working on a different principle. He isn't trying to use a limited vocabulary. In fact, he claims to be the champion of neology. And it's true. There are a lot of words that we know and use that Jefferson was the first to use them and use them in a way, maybe not in all cases made them up, but the example that I always think of is belittle. If you look in the Oxford English Dictionary, the great historical dictionary, for the first recorded use of belittle, It's Jefferson in the Notes in Virginia. Mm-hmm. And there are, somebody has counted these and I've forgotten. There are a number of these words that are of that sort. Lincoln, I think, was not, as Jefferson says somewhere, I'm a friend of neology. I don't think Lincoln would have thought of himself that way, that he would be afraid of making up words. That wouldn't lend itself, that wouldn't fit his theory. He would, but he could do these wonderful things, talk about the way words are used, as I've tried to give examples here. That was his meat. Thanks very much.